I know from my day job working with organisations that there's a real perception in the public sector that trying something, experimenting, innovating, and failing is a bad use of public money. Well, the guardians of value for money in the public sector are the National Audit Office. And today, I put that directly to Johnny Moo, the director of the NAO, and he is unequivocal. It is fine to try, and it is fine to fail. There's a lot more in this conversation as well, so listen on to find out what he thinks. Welcome to Freewheeling, the free-thinking podcast about moving forward faster. My name's Thomas Abelman, and each week I'll bring you fresh voices, new ideas, and unconventional thinking. So let's get started now with this week's edition of the Freewheeling podcast. My guest this week marks people's homework. If you're a public sector worker, he might even be marking yours right now. He's Johnny Mood, and he's director of the National Audit Office. Johnny, welcome to the Freewheeling podcast.
Thank you, Thomas. Lovely to be here. Lovely to speak to you.
So for anyone unfamiliar with your work, tell me, what is the National Audit Office? What do you do, and what may be any misrepresentations of what you do?
Well, I'm sure lots of your listeners are familiar with the NAO, but for those of you who aren't, so the National Audit Office is the auditor of government spending. So we've got two main roles. We audit the financial accounts of departments and their arm's length bodies, so make sure that their income, expenditure, assets and liabilities are accounted for properly. That is the bulk of our work. We do about 400 accounts a year to audit. But the thing probably people know us for is the work we do assessing the value for money of public spending. So those are our value for money reports. We do about 60 of those a year, as well as lessons learned work and other pieces of work sharing our insights. So we produce money on how government's spending your taxpayers' money, not just transport, but people will have seen our recent work, hopefully, on hospitals, regulation of the water sector, capacity of the prison estate, all sorts. So central government is spending money on it. We've probably done some work on it recently, or are planning to do some work on it to make sure that taxpayers' money is being spent well.
And without sounding overly flattering, I have to say, I think your reports are really good. I mean, if you want to get a good summary of how a sector or a public sector area works, you know, who the main players are, what they do, what their roles are, what's working, not working, I think you could do an awful lot worse than read a National Audit Office report.
Oh, well, thank you a lot, Thomas. I mean, that's what we aim for. We, you know, we produce these reports primarily for Parliament, so it needs to be understandable to MPs. But also, we're thinking about think tanks and practitioners and people who are looking to explore the topic area. So we don't claim to be, you know, world-leading experts on X topic that we look at. What we're really good at is auditing a topic area and then explaining that and evaluating it in a way that's accessible for other people. So I'm glad you found out that's what we're aiming for. I think we can always do a bit more on that, but I'm hoping our sort of 10,000 word reports get to the heart of the matter rather than, you know, 100,000 words on something quite technical.
Yeah,
as you say, good leaping off point.
Experience. Now, yeah, but I asked about misconceptions. What would you say? What aren't you that people might think you are?
So a lot of the time people think we come in after the fact and we've got like a little audit checklist of you've done this wrong. Actually, all my experience of working at the National Audit Office, I've been there about 18 years now, loads of our work is forward looking. So loads of it is around how people are managing risk. And thinking about where people are going with something rather than where they've been. So, you know, there's a little bit of backwards looking, but a lot of it is forwards looking. You know, there is a perception that we will sort of dampen down on innovation, which is absolutely not true. That is, we think, if anything, government should be more innovative in terms of how it's approaching work, definitely on transport and other areas, but that should be well managed. So if someone tries something that doesn't work, I think there's a perception that the National Audit Office will come along and say like, ah, well, that was bad value for money, wasn't it? Because you've not achieved what you wanted to achieve. Actually, if it's really well managed, that's something we'll be quite positive about. If there is learning from that, it's conscious risk. So there's a perception of that. I think there's a perception as well that we all kind of sit in Whitehall and are in grey suits, and I'm up in the Northeast. We've got people working all over the place. We're quite a diverse bunch.
And I can confirm that you're actually wearing a grey jumper today.
It's a grey jumper, but not a grey suit. Grey T-shirt. It's a lovely day today. So.
Oh, there we go. It's a grey T-shirt. Come on.
A grey T-shirt, exactly.
The uniform of the modern auditor. So you've dived straight into one of the big topics I want to talk about, which is this question about the perception of experimentation and risk. But I'll come on to that in a sec. But let's just, you skimmed over three critical words, value for money, which I imagine are actually remarkably hard to define. So what is value for money? Because you need to know what it is before you can measure for it. How's value for money defined in the context of unbelievably complex deliverables of public sector organizations?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. It is complicated. We define it sort of relatively simply and then look to apply that to the circumstance of whatever we're looking at. So, you know, good value for money, optimal use of resources, by which we mean economy, efficiency, effectiveness of spending to achieve the intended outcomes. That's at a very high level. Often what we're talking about is, you know, is this a well-planned, well-managed activity that has the outcomes in mind that you're wanting to achieve? And are you doing that in the most efficient way possible, putting the spending in the right place? And what we always do, and I think this comes back to the perceptions of the NEO as well, is you try and understand the context in which people are working within. We had a really big thing during, say, COVID, when departments were saying, well, actually, our plans were knocked off course by COVID. We're a bit worried you're going to come in and say, we haven't done as well as we could. Of course, we're going to say, well, yeah, things didn't go to plan because a pandemic came along. We completely understand that. In that context, how are you responding? So VFM is a big question. What it isn't, to give you a sort of little tangible example, is something straightforward in a way that one of the things, particularly on transport, people might get confused with is that people talk about value for money in the context of benefit cost ratios. And, you know, is the benefit cost ratio of a project positive or negative? And actually, we'll look at it in a much broader sense. So we'll say, well, actually, there's limitations to the way you might do an economic case and calculate your BCR. What's the strategic case? What's the commercial case? How does this all fit together? Is it well managed as a program of work or as a strategy and how you're implementing it? So things like we looked at the Trans-Pennine route upgrade a couple of years back. It's a project in the north. It's a rail project. It's an important project. It's got quite a low BCR. Actually, we were saying this is now set up for success in terms of how it's being managed. So leaving aside the low BCR, this looks as if it's going in the right direction. And actually, the strategic case for it looks as if it's really strong. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of insight into how we think about VFM and how you put it into practice. As you say, it's as much of an art as a science.
So one of the things that really stands out when you look at the United Kingdom is that we have a productivity problem for pretty much every location that's not London and the South East. And we also, another thing you notice, is we have very poor transport links for everywhere that isn't London and the South East. And I, with my huge overwhelming bias, will obviously say that those things are not pure correlation, they're also causation, that one of the reasons we have poor productivity is we have poor transport. But the BCR case you mentioned, your Green Book, will often deprioritise transport investments in cities like Newcastle, because, well, not many people already use them, therefore the incremental number of passengers who are expected to use them. We saw that the Northumberland line is currently doing, I think, five times the number of passengers that were expected. So is there actually a problem? Is BCR delivering us value for money? Are value for money metrics value for money? Because something like the Northumberland line delivering fivefold the number of passengers that it was expected, that suggests that there are potentially really useful deployments of public sector capital to invest in UK PLC that we are currently not making, which is misdeployed capital, which is, you know, a business would be quite alarmed by the thought of.
Yeah, exactly. Northumberland line is very close to my heart as well. It's just around the corner from me. And what's really interesting is that it's delivering that vastly increased numbers from what was forecast and hasn't even fully opened yet. Most of the stations on the line
are still closed.
My local station hasn't been opened yet. So I think, you know, do BCRs service well? I think the problem has always been that BCR is only one part of the planning process and the thinking process, and if anything, too much weight is given on that compared to the other aspects of planning and putting together business case and decision making. As I was saying earlier, it's perfectly reasonable to have a project that has got a low BCR but a really strong strategic case. Is as much effort put into the strategic case for projects, the real reason for why you're doing something, as opposed to the economic case, which feels a bit harder and realer because you've got numbers. I think there's a question there. Probably comes on to a wider issue around how projects are thought about in terms of how much is the outcome that people are looking for from these projects properly in mind from the start, rather than we want to build something specific. You know, we've got a specific project in mind rather than the outcome that we want. Starting with that outcome quickly gets you to the strategic reasons for why you're doing something. And if you're then putting something in the context of there's a really strong reason for doing this, there's limitations to how you calculate a BCR. Actually, we can make a decision off the back of that, even though it's got a low BCR. You know, I think the government's been talking about amending how it does the calculations on that, drawing in some of the wider factors. It's a useful tool in the toolkit. It's not the only thing in the toolkit to be using, I would say.
But you would say, I mean, certainly my perception is, and you would agree, that it is overweighted at the moment. We have a lot of tools in the toolkit, but that's the big hammer we keep whacking with, and then surprised that we keep getting the same result.
I think that's the case. And you can understand why it is, because people like numbers. It's there. Everyone understands it. It's simple to see. It's quite hard to then explain, well, what's the strategic purpose for something, or what's the commercial case alongside that, and all the rest. But we need to get into that space more to actually get the projects that we want to exactly deliver the things you've been talking about there. How do we address productivity in the country? How do we address the things that are important to people? It has to get beyond the BCR.
And how are we going to do that? Because if you create a strategic case as a city to say, actually, we want to reimagine how this city works, and as part of that reimagining, we need a completely different relationship between places in the city. Partly it's around agglomeration, partly it's around placemaking, people, this being a place that bright young graduates want to live in and found businesses, as opposed to that's a very large, complex, system-wide approach that requires fundamental investment over decades, which is the kinds of things that, you know, other countries and other cities have done, just doesn't lend itself to this kind of individual project by project, what's the journey time saving of installing that tram line. So how do we get to a position where we are able to have that kind of purpose-based conversation?
Yeah, well, as you've been hinting at there, it's not simple, it's not straightforward.
Yeah, it's
maybe straying, you know, way into sort of how do you manage the politics of this over longer term. You know, some of it is simple, a lot of it's complex, but actually, as I was saying earlier, starting with the outcomes that you're wanting to achieve and really nailing those. What I thought was really interesting, say, with High Speed 2, when phase two was cancelled, and when there was lots of discussion around why, you know, High Speed 2 is a good thing or a bad thing. Some of the work on that the National Oil Office did on High Speed 2 when it was started was saying, well, look, the strategic case on this isn't particularly well thought through. It's not particularly well articulated. You need to work on that. And maybe they never really got there in terms of, you know, what is this railway for? Phase two was cancelled. You suddenly had lots of people popping up as like, actually, this is really important because of the strategic connections it's going to make between these airports running up the West Coast. It's really important for these aspects with the environment. Articulating the case in a way that actually hadn't been articulated before. Starting with the outcomes of where you are. You know, the example you've given there was taking a place-based approach and saying, like, what is our vision for how can we get people signed up to the outcomes that we want? You know, you can change your projects that will deliver that over time. You'd expect a little bit of change within that. But do you actually have that shared vision of what you're trying to achieve and where you're going to get to over the longer term? If that's missing, it's really hard to see how projects can slot into it and deliver what you want to achieve. So seeing you need that more portfolio approach of where are we getting to, rather than individual programs which by themselves might seem sensible but collectively fail to deliver what you really want to achieve, or deliver it in such a niche, small way that actually lots of people aren't seeing the benefits that you'd want them to see.
I mean, you're right in something you said earlier, which is people love a simple number. And so if the BCR is 1.2, that's good. If it's 0.9, that's bad. And this other stuff is complex. Is there a way of trying to give people the simple number that boils all of these complex strategic considerations down into something that takes you beyond the BCR? Because I'm worried if you have lots of things that are in words and one number, the words will always get thrown over the left shoulder and everyone will just focus on the number. Is there any way of achieving that, do you think?
I am sure there is a way of getting closer to that. It's really tricky, isn't it? Because people want simplicity and want to be able to understand things without having to dive into it too much. But a lot of the things we're talking about have to be really deeply thought through And then you've got to make quite complex trade-offs when you're making decisions around, do we do X or do we do Y? So there's always a place for the numbers and simplicity. There's probably a way of more clearly articulating. So you talk about, you know, people don't like too many words, but can we boil that down and give that a better sense of how it fits into what people want to achieve, the bigger picture? There's probably something there rather than trying to apply a number to it. I'd struggle to say how you'd capture what you want in, say, a strategic case with a number or a RAG rating. You can assess whether it's good or not. You can assess whether it's well thought through or not. But actually that heart of, you know, even though this has got a low BCR, we really want to do it. Or equally, something might have a high BCR and you think, well, you know, it's got high BCR, but strategically, is it really the thing we want to do at the moment?
BCRs can sometimes reward things that actually are not strategically what you want to achieve. You know, you can have a road scheme that claims that it'll save lots of people time, but it also increases carbon emissions and pollution.
Yep, or you can have decisions on BCR and invest entirely in the south and the southeast rather than the north, where it's going to have, you know, potentially a transformational impact on people's lives. You know, we talked about Northumberland line earlier, so that's right by me, and I know the difference that is making to people, say, who live in Blythe and Ashington, about their ability to get into Newcastle for education and employment. You know, capturing all that in a number, you know, you can do it, but it's quite hard, particularly then when you layer in the fact that, you know, it opens up more opportunities for housing growth in those areas and more opportunities for business and different types of land use.
So what would your advice be if you're a scheme promoter who feels like they have got this strategic intent nailed? They can articulate why they want to do the scheme, but they're kind of coming up against the sort of Treasury, civil service, BCR-based economics wall. And whether or not that's a fair perception, it's definitely a perception. I've had enough conversations with people to tell me that that perception exists. What would your advice be to those promoters, given that, as we've discussed, arguably that pure BCR filter isn't necessarily delivering the best value for money for taxpayers?
I mean, some of it is, if they think they've got a really strong strategic case, have the conversations around why that strategic case isn't enough. Like, what is missing? If people are just making decisions on BCR, which, as you say, is a perception, I don't always see that in reality in terms of some of the way I see decision making happening, say, on transport and elsewhere. Don't see that in reality, but it's definitely a perception. If people are seeing that, then they need to call people out on it and say, look, there is a system, a process in place where the BCR is only meant to be part of the decision making process. If you're entirely weighting your decision on that, you're missing the bigger part of the picture. And there's all sorts of, you know, there's the National Audit Office work, there's all sorts of different work people can point to say why that is both an issue and a problem if you do it. Just keep banging the drum on it.
And tell me, you mentioned there you don't think it's actually how decisions are made, but there's a perception it's how decisions are made. Why do you think that, what do you think accounts for that discrepancy?
I think there's a couple of things. I think, as we're talking about with the BCR, it's such a tangible number that people latch onto that and then talk about it. And it's the easy thing for people to talk about. I certainly know when I talk to politicians or think tanks or other people externally around projects, it's one of the things they always want to ask about a project. What's the BCR? Where does it sit? Is it kind of an easy way into a topic area? I think it's also because it's one of the things that people trumpet when they talk about a project. You know, we think this is good value for money because it's got a high BCR. Not because of the transformational benefits it's going to deliver or the outcomes or the difference it will make, because that's not as pithy a soundbite. So it's the thing that people talk about, and it's the thing that people keep talking about. And it's quite easy to say to someone, you know, why didn't your project get approved? It's quite easy to say, well, you know, it had a BCR of under 1 or 1.1, rather than, you didn't do a great case putting together why we should do it, did you?
Yeah. Absolutely. That's really, really interesting and insightful and relevant. Let's come back to that question we talked about earlier around innovation and experimentation, because that's, I definitely feel like, another of these issues where perhaps you, as the guardians of public sector good value, don't necessarily have the same opinion as people attempting to achieve what they think you want. Because there's definitely a perception out there that if you try something, that you think you've got a decent hypothesis, I am trying this because this might be true, I don't know it to be true, and it might easily not be true. And I spend a whole bunch of taxpayers' money on something that might be true, and it turns out it wasn't true, and all that money has gone. I'm not going to say wasted, but it's gone. Taxpayers' money is no longer there. They will get into trouble for that, and they shouldn't do something like that.
Yeah. Well, as you say, I think that's the perception. I think that's a perception we really want to push against in our work. It's not the reality of how we do our audit work or how we think about these issues. Innovation and trying things new, we're not only kind of supportive of that, but we think it's necessary to actually deliver value for money. We're talking earlier about some of the issues facing the country of productivity. You know, you chuck resilience into that, you know, really big issues around rising demand, not enough money to fix the gaps in public services, all sorts of wider kind of strategic issues. If you don't have good research and innovation on some of those areas, you're actually never going to tackle those long-term complex policy goals and achieve the things you want to achieve. The thing we are down on is where people say, oh, that didn't work, but don't worry, it's fine, and try and move on. If someone is saying, well, look, we want to make a difference with something, we've got an idea, we want to test something out, and actually we've thought about the risk appetite we have within this, and it's within our risk appetite. We thought about the type of data and information we can collect on this so we can learn from it. We're going to test and learn and try and move quickly on this and stop it if it's not working. And then we're going to take our learning from that and plow it into the next thing. Super. That is the type of thing which over the longer term will deliver value for money. We like to see it and we want to see it. I think probably in our work we'll be calling it out more when we see it as a positive step. Things that have not delivered what a department or government might want. But actually, there's really rich learning from that they've been able to apply elsewhere. Because otherwise, you stagnate, things stay the same. I think people think things don't work at the moment. So actually, do you want things to stay the same? You don't. You need to experiment and learn. Doing that in a controlled way, where you are understanding the risk you're running and what you're willing to tolerate and how that fits in with your overall objectives. And like I say, you've got the risk appetite, right? All good stuff, all things we want to see, and actually some of the hallmarks of well-managed programs of work that will deliver value for money. So where we see that, very positive about it. Where we see poorly thought through plans that didn't really understand what was trying to be achieved, what the risks were of doing it, haven't really got a way of learning from what was being done and haven't evaluated it, we'll say, well, that's not delivering value for money. Because you've not achieved what you wanted to do, and you've wasted that resource in doing so. You can not achieve what you wanted to achieve on something, and still learn from that, and still get value for money from that experience. But so too often we see people where we have been critical of that is where they haven't thought about how this works, and maybe don't realise that they're properly innovating, experimenting. They're just throwing money at a problem. And then not really getting anything out of it at the end.
So the key thing here is to be clear what you're actually trying to achieve, to be able to articulate the outcome you're going for when you run an experiment, and to be clear, you know whether you've achieved it or not. They're the things that have to be in place, but actually certainty of success is not one of the things that has to be in place.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's all relative. You know, we'd expect people to have, you know, what we refer to as a kind of risk appetite around this, you know, with the type of activity we're doing, what is our risk appetite? You know, if you're doing something that relates to health and safety, you're going to be kind of at the reverse minimalist side because, you know, you're not
absolutely
wanting to like experiment in that area. If actually this is about your kind of strategic delivery of objectives, you want to be really bold in those areas. You want to be trying out multiple things because that's where the big wins come from. So it's fine when you're swinging big to have a few misses in a controlled environment where you're understanding where your risk is, because actually you've got loads of other activities where you're like, you know, we're open to risk here, we're cautious here, we're averse here. That kind of portfolio approach of activity where you're thinking around how does this fit into what our organization is trying to achieve, where are we placing our big bets, how are we managing that and then learning from it. That is where you really start to both deliver value for money and the sort of the real transformational benefits of innovation. And we want to see more of that. And I think probably lots of the people listening... Sorry, go on, Thomas.
No, you can.
I was going to say, probably one of the areas as well, you know, we're talking maybe, because the National Office looks at big projects, we're talking about, you know, often you know, big programs of work. Lots of your listeners will be interested in how they innovate on a small scale. I think it's probably, you know, a lot of the same principles apply, particularly when you're, you know, often what we don't see enough distinction between other things where you can roll back from whatever you're testing. You know, if you can test something and it doesn't work and then undo it quite quickly, then go ahead and do it. Give it a go.
Exactly,
try it.
Exactly what I was actually about to raise, because one of my favorite little phrases is one of Amazon's, which I just use all the time, which is the phrase one-way door, two-way door. One-way door, decision, you make it. Once you've made it, it's really hard to change it. That's the kind of decision you should plan and business case and have a big spreadsheet and test and approve. A two-way door is a decision you make it. If you don't like the outcome of it, it's very easy to go back. Actually, the process of spreadsheeting it and seeking approvals is in itself a poor use of resources compared to the resource to just try it. That achieves that. That's not an outcome we wanted. Back to where we started. And you've expended less resource and less cost in just seeing what it is than trying to model what it is.
Yeah, and often cheaper and quicker to just try it and see if it works. Particularly if you're talking about things that are kind of zero cost or low cost. You know, often you want to just encourage people to have a learning environment where they go ahead and do that and try it. Like you say, if you can understand if it's working or not, and you can row back from it, and you're not losing much in terms of money or time or resources or impact on people, that's where you get proper innovation and incremental change and good ideas. And you know, you see examples of that all over the place in transport. You know, some of them larger scale because they've got, you know, grant funding applied, but other things where people have just got a bright idea and give it a go and see what works.
I think that's a really important point there, because I think people feel like they need an Innovate UK competition to give them permission to do this stuff. And I think the message you're giving them is actually, no, you have permission to do this stuff. What your organisation's rules, what your boss wants you to do is one thing. But in terms of managing public money, the fact that it's public money does not mean that you, in your job, wherever you are, can't be running experiments to test what works.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And if you've got a good idea, what's really stopping it? I heard one thing recently, which I'm not sure if it's true or not, because people sort of tell these stories and they get a life of their own. But heard a great story about how National Highways and Network Rail teamed up to help them assess the condition of roads and rail, which are often kind of next to each other. And it was someone who's had access, part of the air unit within Network Rail. And they're in the helicopter and they're like, well, I can see the roads and the rail are next to each other. Let's work together.
Yeah,
let's do that. Absolutely. And actually, you know, it's the kind of the small scale stuff. And actually, it's saved them time and it saved them a bit of money, gets them a better information. They're now using that to explore how you use different technologies to sort of more easily assess that. It impacts on, you know, more reliable networks as a consequence. Brilliant. You know, coming from, you know, a bright idea, a bit of joint working, all good stuff. You know, it doesn't need, you know, a 60,000, 600,000, £6 million grant from Innovate UK to get you there, and it's still making a difference and helping improve things.
Right, I'm just going to take a very short break. The reason for the break is so I can tell you, my listeners, a bit about freewheeling the business as opposed to freewheeling the podcast. In a world which demands ever faster change, it can feel hard sometimes to make that happen. I help transport and mobility organisations innovate, solve challenges and achieve faster results. If this sounds like something you're interested in, visit www.freewheeling.com. So, Johnny Mood, I mentioned earlier your excellent reports on transport. You issued some pretty tough reports. I mean, on rail reform last year, you issued a pretty tough report on the status of rail reform. Looking into transport from the outside, is the management of transport getting better? Or
the things I see are, over time, are increasing professionalisation, upskilling, focus on outcomes. Part of the thing you're touching on is the fact that we look at some of the biggest, most difficult, challenging things that government and transport are doing, and so naturally that won't always be perfect. There's kind of a nice like rising tide of improvement over time, and within that we might say, well, actually, say rail reform, the largest transformation program in government. It's like so big you can see it from space. It's massive. And I think at the time of our report, we were saying it's been done quite quickly, given the scale of that transformation. You're trying to build the program as you're running it. that's running quite a lot of risk. Is it well thought through? You know, you might, you know, that's to be expected. Day to day, are things, you know, gradually improving in terms of different areas of activity? You'd like to think so. That's not coming through in terms of how people are experiencing the transport network, which for me is probably the key thing. So we can get, and one of the things we keep chipping away in our work, you can get better at some of the technical aspects, you can get better at some of the upskilling. The real thing with all this, though, is that you might run a project better. Are you delivering a better outcome for the people who are using the transport system? And just using that as well as this kind of mirror to hold up against all the positive things that people might have in their projects or activities on their RAG ratings and how they're managing risk and all the rest. If you're not actually achieving a better outcome for the people who are using the transport system, then that suggests you've got a further way to go. And on that, you know, there's more to do, isn't there? I don't think people are content with the state of public transport at the moment. That's partly the purpose of the rail reform program. I think it's going to be a longer term program of work than maybe people on the street think about, but you can read across to what's happening on local roads. Department is putting a lot of money into that, but actually do people experience that in a way that they would want to at the moment? Probably not. Buses is probably similar. Active travel, lots of positive things there, but you know, people are wanting to see probably more focus on walking and support for that as opposed to cycling. So lots of areas of improvement, but more to do on that focus of actually what's the outcome we're getting for people, and are we really focused on that and delivering that.
And one of the things you did then is listed a whole bunch of different transport modes. And one of the things that's really encouraging at the moment, I think, is the fact that we're actually for the first time in, yeah, goodness knows how long since I was very young in early in my career, coming up with a national transport strategy, and that one didn't really go very far. I recently rewatched the Yes Minister episode from the 80s about the national transport strategy, and it felt like very little had changed since that time. But it feels like one of our sort of transport pathologies in the UK over decades, arguably centuries, is our tendency outside London to treat every transport mode completely independently, with the reporting lines, the management, the ticketing, the timetabling, everything just meeting in Whitehall, and literally not even below that. Hopefully that's something that can then start to achieve value for money from the point of view of a user, because a user makes journeys, they don't use its modes.
Exactly. And I, you know, we haven't seen the integrated transport strategy yet becoming later this year, but I'm hoping that's going to be a really positive step, because it gets to the heart of how people experience transport. It's, you don't just drive your car, you're going to walk, you're going to get the bus, you're going to get a train. You want to be thinking about how it works together as a system, how it works for people to connect to different areas. You want to think, and I'm seeing more of that when I'm talking to people around how people are thinking about the whole journey for people. So one of the conversations have been happening, I'm doing some work on buses at the moment, one of the conversations have been happening with people is around accessibility on buses. And, you know, interesting where things are going on that in terms of a lot of the regulation and accessibility criteria at the moment is based on the vehicle, the bus itself, but not the bus shelter and how you get to the bus and how you experience that whole journey. And so I'm really hopeful, from what I've been hearing so far, the integrated transport strategy is going to start to get into that area, or at least point that to be the right way of thinking about this in terms of how are you thinking about this. Because a lot of your listeners, and you will have experienced this, what you want is an integrated system. You don't want to buy three different tickets to get from A to B. You want things to join up. You want to be able to walk comfortably to a bus stop and get that bus, and then that bus joins up with the timetable of a train, and then you get that train. That's where we need to get to, because that's what people want. No one cares whether, you know, who runs a particular thing. They want to be able to get from A to B.
So one of the places I always bang on about this, one of the places that does this incredibly well is Switzerland, which just have the most extraordinarily integrated timetable and fare system, and everything joins up utterly seamlessly. They're obviously a richer country than we are. Do you do much benchmarking to kind of assess what value for money looks like in different countries, what outcomes are achievable in different countries, taking into account the fact that they've got different resources and different priorities, but nevertheless, there are common objectives across multiple different regions and geographies?
It's a really good challenge. To be honest, it's one of the areas we want to do more of, and it's something definitely we're going to be focused on over the next few years, not just on transport, but as an organisation. It's probably a bit too patchy at the moment where we've done that. it can be quite tricky and
time-consuming
to do it in a way that kind of meets our standards, meets our ability to talk to Parliament about how this compares to the UK because of those differences. But when we get it right, and when Parliament can use it in the right way, and when other people using our reports can use it, it's really instructive, can really illuminate kind of both different approaches as well as kind of performance. So again, using the kind of the buses example, doing some work on that at the moment. Really interesting, been talking to people about international comparisons there on the move to zero emission buses and where we stand on that. We've been playing around with a bit of international data. People have been saying, well, you know, UK is quite low down in terms of the number of zero emission buses bought as a percentage of all buses. We started to unpick that a little bit. Actually, when you look at the major markets for buses, so countries that are buying, you know, 1,000 plus buses a year, UK is coming out on top over the last few years. It's above the average across the rest of the EU. Yes, there's, you know, lessons to be learned from kind of smaller countries that moved to net zero buses earlier. There's learning to be done, but that context of actually, given where we are and some of the better comparator nations, actually doing all right. And that's where we want to try and use international comparisons more to both make sense of it and being able to both describe performance, but then be able to point to say, well, you know, but there are other people doing things differently in different circumstances. What's the learning from that?
Final couple of questions from me. It's always interesting talking to people who are kind of half in and half out of the transport sector. You know, you've done a lot of work in transport, but you're not a transport person. Mm. What are the key things that you see that make transport people different or unique, or our sector different and unique? And what are the things that we think are different and unique and actually we're completely wrong and they're common to everyone?
I think there's far more commonality than uniqueness, I would say. Far more. I think I would just go with that. I think that the major thing I've seen across my career at National Audit Office and talking to other people, and, you know, I've done transport at the moment. Previously, I've done things like DEFRA and EU Exit and HMRC, DWP. Everyone explains to you how unique what they're doing is and how challenging it is and how difficult, and no one else has faced the same set of problems. And they explain those problems, and it's pretty much the same as what you've just been talking about with someone in a different area. And this is one of the things we try and get across in some of the National Audit Office work when we do lessons learned work. I think one of the key things we want to get across is there's a lot of commonality. There's a lot of lessons and things you can learn from other people in government, other people in different sectors, people just doing entirely different things, but actually find the bits that are common and find the common problems. And you often find that people are dealing with the same broad concepts, broad ideas, challenges and risks, and there's loads you can learn from that. And that's really where you get the real benefit from our work, but also kind of from making improvement. You know, you might not think there's much you can learn from, you know, prison estate reform or something, but actually, you know, applying that to rail reform, how were they thinking about that problem? How did they go about it? How did they plan it? How did they deal with their stakeholders? What were the political challenges? What were the things that they knew were going to happen over the next few years that they planned for? How can you go through planning legislation? Right? How can you draw that learning in, even though it's a completely different sector? So, yeah, I would say when I talk to people, I'd say, you are unique and special, but probably not as unique and special as you think you are.
I'm Johnny Mood, Director of the National Audit Office. Thank you so much for joining me on the Freewheeling Podcast.
Thanks, Thomas. Lovely speaking.
Thank you so much to Johnny Mood, Director of the National Audit Office. And thank you to you for listening. I'll be back next week. If you feel like going onto Spotify or Apple Podcasts for a quick rate and review, that would be wonderful. I look forward to being with you again next Thursday. Bye-bye.